I want to talk this morning about right intention or upright intention. Seemed like a good time of year to talk about that. I also, after that, I want to tell you a story. It's a true story of heroics and bravery and feats of unbelievable strength. So it's a good story. But first, right intention. So this is a time of year when we often think about, you know, the direction of our lives and, you know, what we should be doing and things like that. But I don't want to confuse right intention with New Year's resolutions, which are, I think, more sort of mundane and goal-oriented. You know, want to get a new job, want to, you know, get to the gym more often, want to be nicer to my brother, want to da-da-da, stuff like that. But right intention is more like our ideals. And it's even, you could say it's closer to motivation. It's closer to motivation. It's sort of that overarching resolve that we use to orient our lives in a particular way. New Year's resolutions can also sound a lot like intentions also. Jerry Stieber, who's a Sangha member here and isn't here this morning, I warned him I was going to talk about this. he teaches Intro to Zazen on Tuesday nights. Jerry has three New Year's resolutions this year. He said this was okay to talk about. Be kind, be mindful, and be happy. And when I heard those, first of all, it made me happy. But I thought, you know, those could be intentions, you know, because they aren't that kind of mundane, here's how I'm going to get around the rock kind of things. They define how he wants to live, and that in turn is going to drive his actions this year. So that's kind of the difference between a resolution and a right intention. And of course, right intention is the second in the Noble Eightfold Path, right after right view. And of course, right in this context doesn't mean right, wrong. It just means, it means more like upright, upright intention. And the Eightfold Path isn't necessarily sequential, but I think that right view does lead into right intention. I think about right view, usually I think about bodhicitta arising. Bodhicitta being bodhi, being awakening, citta meaning heart mind. So it's the awakening of the heart mind. And another way to think of it is seeing things as they really are, unclouded by our thought coverings and our wishes and our obsessions and our aversions, just things as they really are. So right view underpins right intention. It underpins it. It inspires it. It supports it. I was walking home after evening zazen a couple of weeks ago. It was right after one of those big storms that we had, one of the big giant snows. And I was walking home, and when I walk home, I get to go around the lake. It's really pretty. I live about 2 miles from here. And it was night, and it was starry out. And I had been kind of thinking about it, about intention. And I was walking along, and I was looking up at the stars, and I started thinking, you know, right view is kind of like seeing the stars and understanding that they show up at predictable places in the sky at predictable times. And then right intention is like saying, I'm going to navigate by that star. I'm going to navigate by the North Star. I'm going to navigate by the moon. So I was thinking about it as celestial navigation, which sounded very grand. But I think that's what it's like. It's like turning your life and saying, this is the general direction that my life is going to go. I'm orienting my life. In my case, then you come to, okay, so if that's your grand intention, smart girl, what is your intention? And that night, the only thing I could come up with was, I'm orienting my life towards the Dharma. So everything that I do should be in tune with the Dharma. So it was a beautiful night. I've been reading Jack Kornfield, his new book, The Wise Heart, Guide to the Universal Teachings of Buddhist Psychology. And he says, setting a long-term intention, excuse me, is like setting the compass of our heart. No matter how rough the storms, how difficult the terrain, even if we have to backtrack around obstacles, our direction is clear. So, it's not earthbound. But we're still having terrain and obstacles and storms and rivers to cross and things. But we set our compass so we know where we're going. And we don't do this out of a sense of duty, and we also don't do it out of a sense of this is going to make my life better. It's going to make my life better. But the reason that we do it is because we've awakened to something, and that inspires us to realign our heading for our direction. So it's really something more that pulls us in a certain direction than our saying, well, I better do this because it'll make me a good person, or it'll make me a stronger person, or God forbid, it'll make me a better Buddhist. So here's Kornfield again. He gave a quote from Thomas Merton when Merton was advising a young activist. And the first part of it is do not depend on the hope of results. You may have to face the fact that your work will be apparently worthless and even achieve no result at all, if not perhaps results opposite to what you expect. So that's encouraging. But then he goes on to say, as you get used to this idea, you start more and more to concentrate not on the results, but on the value, the rightness, the truth of the work itself. So that's where we're going with right intention. We're trying to kind of keep our eyes on the prize, to keep our eyes on the value, the rightness, and the truth of it, and then align our daily activities with that. And if we are going to do that, we just can't get distracted by imagining outcomes, you know. Because if we do, that's going to just lead us over here. You know, intentions are carried out for their own sake, and they're carried out, I think, with a spirit of curiosity and adventure. About a month ago, I gave a talk about sticking with one thing, and I talked about equanimity and about how I'm very interested in equanimity, and I want to stick with it for about a year and just look at it and see what I see and see where it pops up and see when I feel it and see when I don't feel it. And at the time, I didn't think about that as an intention at all. I just thought of it as something that I was interested in and I wanted to look at. But the more I thought about intention, the more I realized that equanimity had turned into an intention. So this last week, there was one day when I was out and about, And I was going all day. And I got home at about 6:30 at night, and I was really tired, and I was kind of jacked up, you know how you get. And I was hungry, and there were a couple of things that I really needed to do at home that night. And I decided that I really didn't want to do them in that state of mind, because it's just so unpleasant. So I took off my coat and put away my coat and made some dinner and had some dinner. And then I sat down and read for a little while, because reading really calms me down. And then after a while I could tell, okay, now you've got yourself calmed down. Now go do the things you want to do. And it was a lot more pleasant. But it was because I'd had that, first that thinking about equanimity, which turned into the intention of equanimity, that let me do those things with equanimity, because it had been on my mind and I'd been thinking about it and I remembered it. And then when you do that, it reinforces itself. So it's self-reinforcing. And then you might remember the next time. So I recommend it from that standpoint. So, intention. I asked somebody one time, a long time ago, what distinguishes zazen from just sitting down quietly? And I don't remember what the answer was, but a couple of weeks afterwards, it occurred to me that the difference between sitting in zazen and just sitting quietly for half an hour is intention. It's intention. It's the overarching intention that you sit down with, that this is what I'm going to do. And it's also the moment-by-moment intention of where you bring yourself back, and bring yourself back, and bring yourself back. You know, we can't really control what comes up in our minds too well. You know, you might be sitting with busy mind, or you might have the song to Petticoat Junction stuck in your head. Don't ever get that as a ringtone. It won't leave you. But anyway, you can't control that kind of thing. But you can have that intention that every time I hear the whistle on the track, I will come back. I will come back. I don't want to be too sort of reductionist about zazen, because actually the more I do it, the more mysterious it is to me. But I try to approach it both with the intention to just sit down and follow Dogen's instructions, and a lack of desire to achieve some particular result, and to always come back. So every so often I'll just pick up Fukan Zazengi and read it, because the Dogen's Universal Recommendations for Zazen, because actually they are really fabulous instructions for zazen. And excuse me, in there he says, devote your energies to a way that directly indicates reality. Continuously perform as such and you will be such a person. It's one of my very favorite lines in there. Continuously perform as such and you will be such a person. I think whenever I read that, I think Dogen's got a lot of confidence in me, you know. Why can't I have a little more in myself? So, you're devoting your energies, and you aren't worrying yourself about, this is going to make me this kind of person, this is going to make me a healthier person, a happier person, a more zen-like person. You're just devoting your energies and becoming the kind of person that you become from that. So I like to take Dogen's word on that one. It's very encouraging, I think. The one thing that we need that he alludes to in there when he says, devote your energies, that we need is constancy. And we need that constancy. It comes from patience and practice. And by practice there, I mean building up the habit. So it comes through patience and practice and mindfulness and sort of keeping that intention with us all the time, keeping it somewhere nearby all the time so that you remember it. And once we've firmly established that sort of navigational direction, and we're holding it consistently, then no matter what comes up in our lives, our natural response is going to be in alignment with our intention. It will keep us sort of oriented in that direction. And whenever I hear somebody say something grand like that, I always think, all right, but what does that mean in my life, in my daily life? How do I do that? And I usually say, comma, wise guy. Wise person. So Cornfield on page 269 talks about something he calls the sacred pause. He says the sacred pause is a moment where we stop and release our identification with problems and reactions. In a moment of stopping, we break the spell between past result and automatic reaction. And he goes on to say, in this pause, we can examine our intention. If we have set a long-term intention or dedication for our life, we can remember our vows. By vow, I think he means intention there. And then he says, it is in our hands. So when I'm looking to sort of connect the grand statements about, you know, aligning my life, it's like I'm going to see the clouds part and the angels thing. But that feels very grand when you talk about it in that way. But you can bring it right down to your life by saying, take a pause, take a breath, take a breath. Especially when the moment that you're in is a potentially upsetting moment or a moment where you know that your immediate reaction might not be out of the best place within you. But just in the space of that one breath, we can remember to go back to our intention and act out of that. And then there's the times when we act out of the very best of intentions and things go spectacularly wrong. Maybe you know somebody who sort of flits through life with the best of intentions, causing chaos all around them. Anybody know anybody like that? Maybe you are somebody like that. I don't know. But I think even of us, you know, all of us do that at some point. You know, we think that we're acting out of a very noble intention, and then things don't come out in the least bit well. Cornfield says it's because there's delusion in there. There's delusion in there. And I thought, oh, Jack, that's a little harsh. But I think he's right, that when that happens, there's something behind it that really hasn't been looking at the situation. And the solution that the Buddha offered, this is why the Buddha said that we should have spiritual friends. He said we should associate with wise and noble friends. So look at the person on your left and the person on your right. Those are your wise and noble friends. That's why we need Sangha. Friends who will kindly and truthfully tell you what they think and what they see. So we need those spiritual friends. And if we have those, and a teacher, it really is Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, a teacher, the teachings, and friends, that will keep us in alignment with our intention. So that's what I want to say about intentions this morning. And I left myself some time to tell my story. And it has to do on your bulletin, this wonderful quotation from Kate, thank you. "Nothing ever good follows the thought, what's that dripping sound?" I heard that, I thought it was very clever, and then this week I got to experience it. It was on Wednesday. That was the day when it was really warm. It was 40 degrees or something like that. It was on Wednesday. And I was upstairs in the office with Kim. We were working on the computer, and we were on a conference call with a consultant. And we were talking to him, and all of a sudden we heard this really loud drip, drip, drip. And we turned around, and we saw water dripping from the ceiling, her nice new, newly repaired ceiling, and there was actually a bulge in the ceiling. Yeah, that was what we said. And then there was this flurry of activity. Kim ran and got some buckets and put them under the drip, and then she got something and poked a hole in the bulge, and then the water came out. And she called James, who takes care of our building, and she called Bill Tresh, who fortunately was at home that day. And the next thing I know, Kim and Bill were up on the third floor balcony, and they were looking at a little lake that had formed up there. And Bill kind of waded out across it and found out that the downspouts on each end of the balcony had frozen shut. So there's one on this side and one on that side, and they're both frozen shut. I told the consultant that we were talking with on the phone, who had kept kind of talking through all this, and I said, Kim has actually left the room just now because we discovered a leak in our ceiling, and I think I'm going to have to go too. And so the next thing I know, I was up on the balcony with them, and we were shoveling snow. There was just a ton of snow up there, and a little lake. And so Bill went and got the wet vac, and he cleared everything off the third floor, off the altar in that room, and put the wet vac on it. He said, I think he said, "Pardon me, Buddha," before he did it, but I wouldn't swear to it. And then he snaked the hose to the wet vac out the window, and I held it down into the lake, and we sucked water out of the lake and into the wet vac. And I want to say we got at least 5 wet vacs full of water off of the balcony. And he would take it when it was almost full, and he would sort of stagger over into the bathroom and dump it in the bathtub. And then that happened. And then we realized that we really needed more help. So Kimberly called Stacy, who came riding over on her bicycle. She came riding over, and I called my husband, Dave, and I said, I want to ask you for 2 levels of favor. You know, the first one is, would you bring over my waterproof boots and a new pair of mittens, because my mittens were soaked. And he said, sure. And I said, and would you bring another snow shovel and help us shovel a lot of heavy snow off of the upper balcony? And he said, sure. So he came over too. What a guy. So, you know, we just started shoveling and shoveling and shoveling, and there were big icicles that were like this long up there. And that balcony has a rubber membrane all around it to keep the water from going through. So we had to be using plastic snow shovels, and you had to be really careful, you know, how far you dug into it, because we didn't want to make Kimberly's ceiling any more bad looking than it was. So we and we couldn't throw the snow off of the front of the building because there's another balcony underneath it, and also that's where our sidewalks were in. We didn't really want to be shoveling the snow again off the sidewalks. So we had to shovel. So we had a couple of people who were shoveling from the middle of the balcony to the sides of the balcony, and then a couple of other people would shovel the snow then over the edge of the balcony. So when Bill was done with the wet vac, he went to take it off the altar, and he noticed that that a little bit of water had gotten on the altar, and then he noticed that the altar up there has a hinge in it. And I hadn't known this, but the third floor altar is actually a storage container. So he lifted it up to see if any water had leaked through, and he found a number of scrolls, and he found some fans, and he found just some other, you know, there was a batik wall hanging of Buddha. I mean, you know, and who knew this stuff was up there? We thought that we had found every single hidey hole in this building, and we're always finding new ones. So he laid those out. He stretched those out on the floor on the third floor room, and found out that none of them had gotten damaged. So yay, Bill! And during a break, we went and looked at them and went, wow, look at this one! Wow, look at this one! And then we found a new home for them that wasn't under the third floor altar. And then we got back to shoveling, and shoveling, and shoveling, and shoveling. It's probably why Bill isn't here today. but it wasn't grim. It was actually kind of, well, it wasn't fun either. But it was, but we were laughing and telling stories and things. So we're shoveling. And the next day, Kimberly got the guy in from the roofing company, and he said that first of all, that we'd done a very good job shoveling the snow off of the balcony, and if they had to do it for us, they would have charged us up to about $1,000. So that made it seem even less grim that we had to do it. But he also said that he didn't see any structural damage, and he thought that what had happened was that because our roof isn't as well insulated as it should be, which was no surprise to us, that, you know, the heat from the house had caused the snow on the roof to melt, and then it went up through the roof and caused ice dams. And we had put in extra roofing material so that wouldn't happen, but it happened even higher up than that. And he also took care of the downspouts for us and got those cleaned out. And by the way, the last work period of the fall, I think, we had somebody rake all the leaves off of that porch. And I want to thank whoever that person was, because if we had had all those leaves on that porch too, we would have had a real mess. And there were probably a few that got down into the downspout, and that's probably what helped cause the backup. But anyway, he got the downspouts clear, and he told us that we should, anytime we get any significant amount of snow, that we should be sure we get up there and make sure the downspouts are clear and they're running, so that that won't happen again. So the reason I'm telling this story is because it's just one of the many little adventures that happen around here during the week. And a lot of people come together at different times to take care of this building in times of crisis like that, and doing regular maintenance too. And this time it happened to be Kim and Bill and Stacy and Dave. Thank you all very much. You get all the thanks, Stacy, because you're the one here. But other times, it's been James and Matt and Will and Rebecca, and I know there are a whole lot of people who, you know, come here and do a lot of work. So I want to encourage you, if you would like during tea, to go up to Kimberly's office and take a look at her ceiling. And we're going to get it fixed, and I'm hoping that we can get some more insulation in there, if we can find some money for that. And I also wanted to say that if your person is willing to do any snow shoveling and ice shoveling at all this winter, we can always use help with that. So please let us know. And also to be sure and maintain mindfulness around the sound of drips in this building, because they are never a good thing. And we have had them in various places. So if you ever hear something dripping in this building, please don't ignore it. So that's my story of heroic feats and aching backs and fun at Zen Center on Wednesday and on Thursday for Kim. I tried to tie it together with intention, and I couldn't do it. I intended to tie it together with intention. There, I did it. So anyway, so that's what I wanted to say about intention, and that's a story I wanted to tell. Anybody else have something they want to... Does anybody else have stories of valor around here? There are, but they don't live on the third floor balcony. Yeah. It went from the third floor down into Kimberly's office, and I don't think it affected the apartment at all. Nope. So, we've had things drip from the apartment into the founders hall before. One time, the radiator, something went. It blew up. You know where the radiators have the little handle? There was just a fountain that came out of it all of a sudden. Poof! And it was one of the nights during, we were in practice period. It was the second half of practice period. And we were going to gather into small groups, but instead we gathered into bucket brigades and moppers, and that's what we did instead. I really don't like to think about what would happen if one of these things occurred when nobody was around. You know, we were closed this week. And, anyway. So. Anybody else have anything they want to talk about? You don't have to top that story.
I guess I wanted to just comment or maybe express an observation which came to me while you were talking about right intention, which is it seems to be kind of the bridge between understanding and thinking about Buddhism, which is kind of the first thing that really needs to happen,
mm-hmm.
and actually acting in a Buddhist way, in a Buddhist lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
But intention itself is not so much an action.
Right.
So it's also important not to get hung up in intention. Like if you have a bunch of intentions and you don't do anything with them.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the New Year's resolution problem.
Uh-huh.
You know. Yeah. Yeah.
So although the Eightfold Path isn't kind of sequential, but the next thing that come, the next six things are all things that you do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's not like one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight.
They all kind of talk to each other. And I think, you know, the next ones are speech, action, and livelihood, which are all going to fall out of your intention. And then the one after that is effort. And I think effort is another thing that really underpins intention. But yeah, we don't want to get hung up on thinking about the intention so much as sort of holding it and having it nearby. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, and I'm not sure I want to say that. I don't think we sit down and pick an intention. Do you? I think maybe it appears, or sort of comes out of our studies and our thoughts. Maybe.
I think maybe a more sincere intention, yeah, kind of arises experientially.
Because
if you try to do something, it's not going to happen until you have some kind of real connection.
Exactly. It's that real connection. It's that real connection that you need.
So about 3 weeks ago, I was in Michigan. I was in the hospital. She had surgery. She went to my brother and my father. And she was under the effect of the law. And so she says, "Glenn, look." She's staring at heaven and what turned out to be just a ball of trash or something. Okay. I'm looking. She said, "Watch." Very intense, very focused. Bam. Did you see it? Things coming out of it. Any intention I had at that time was to completely be extra to that situation. No way I could have anticipated anything. And so, just kind of being with mom and her hallucination was fun because I don't get to have them on my own anymore. not to have fun at my own expense, but she was a little concerned about things emerging from the trash effect. And just kind of assuring her that it was all okay. You know, after she was troubled by it, so she kind of felt it like it was okay. And then she was off to the next kind of hallucination. So that whole thing of attention to be meaningful, I guess, to me,
at the moment,
instead of intention in the moment, that's what I'm actually.
Yeah, I might. I remember when you were getting ready to go on that trip, because we're Facebook buddies, and amazing how much you learn on Facebook. And I was really, I don't remember how you worded it, but it was. It really struck me that what you were doing was getting on that plane and you were just going to mom. You know, you weren't going there with any sort of idea or agenda. But there was this intention, this sort of, this is what I do, my mom. Getting on that plane to Kalamazoo.
I like to end that sometimes the different intention would be bopped on the head. And when Rosemary was shoveling and Bill Trench was drinking water, I was sitting in the third floor studying, preparing for a class on the Diamond Super, which is not easy enough, really involved. And Bill was coming in, dumping water. And I looked in the other room and people were shoveling. And I thought, well, that's great. And I just read and read and read. And when it was all over, I thought, why didn't somebody bop me over the head? I'm an older guy, but still.
Well, okay, you said it. That's why. We said, you know, guy's in there and he's working. Oh, man. I think we're going to save his back as our 57 and 58-year-old backs were just barely doing it. That's why we were glad to see Stacy's younger back arrive.